All right, Genesis chapter 14, 1 to 16. Genesis 14 is about an attack on Sodom and Gomorrah and some other cities and areas down below the what's now the Dead Sea, and about how Abraham goes after the bad guys, gets everything back that was stolen, including the people, meets a priest named Melchizedek. They do something like the Lord's Supper, do something like a tithe, and that finishes up the chapter. So there's a lot in here. Doesn't, you know, sometimes you look at this stuff and you think, well, that's he just told us all there is for Sunday school. Let's go drink coffee and we'll get back in here about 11 and have some church. But there's actually a lot more here. And so let's go ahead and read it so you understand the context, and then we'll actually begin to break it down. All right, verse 1. It came to pass in the days of Amraphel, king of Shinar, Arioch, king of Elasar, Chedorlaomer, king of Elam, and Tidal, king of nations. Let me just stop there for a second. I've got a... we're going to find a map here that all of you can see, but you might get some idea where you are here. This is the Mediterranean Sea, and so this is Israel here. This is the Dead Sea here. And the area that these kings come from is right here. This is Babylon here. This is the Euphrates River and the Tigris River coming down. This would form the Persian Gulf, if you could see it all. And these kings are in this region here. And notice Tidal is called, the Tidal is the king of nations. So they're going to be a type of the United Nations. That's a group of kings. And they have control over this region down here in Genesis chapter 14, verse 2. That these made war with Bera, king of Sodom, and with Birsha, king of Gomorrah, and Shinab, king of Adma, and Shemeber, king of Zeboam, and the king of Bela, which is Zoar. All these were joined together in the Vale of Siddim, which is the Salt Sea. Okay, these guys are joined in this vale here, this valley. This would go on down to this water here, which is Ezion-Geber in the beginning of the Red Sea on the Sinai Peninsula. So they're in this valley here where those kings are. And they're joined together, which is the Salt Sea. 12 years they served Chedorlaomer. In the 13th year they rebelled. Well, Chedorlaomer is the king of Elam. He would be what would then become Persia. They're serving this king here for 12 years. The 13th year they say, that's it, we've had it, we're rebelling. And the 14th year, Chedorlaomer came with those other kings and attacked these areas, the Rephaims in Ashtaroth, Karnaim, and the Zuzims in Ham. Ham would be on down further, because as we saw earlier, the Hamitic people settled off down on into Africa, and the MMs in Sheva and Kiriathaim, and the Horites in their Mount Seir. Mount Seir is right down here, where Selah-Petra is and that kind of stuff. In their Mount Seir, unto El Paran, which is by the wilderness. And they returned and came to Mishpat, which is Kadesh, and smote all the country of the Amalekites and the Amorites that dwelt in Hazion Tamar, down over in this area, right here. And there went out the king of Sodom and Gomorrah, Adma, Zeboam, Bela, the same as Zoar, and they joined battle with them in the Vale of Siddim, with Chedorlaomer, the king of Elam, Tidal, king of nations, Amraphel, king of Shinar, Arioch, king of Elasar, four kings with five, and the Vale of Siddim was full of slime pits. And the king of Sodom and Gomorrah fled and fell there. Doesn't mean necessarily they fell in there, but in that region, that's where they died. Some of them were killed there. Fell there, and they that remained fled to the mountain. And they took all the goods of Sodom and Gomorrah and all their victuals, spelled victuals, but it's victuals, that's the Beverly Hillbillies, granny cooking victuals for Jethro, and went their way, and they took Lot, Abram's brother's son, who dwelt in Sodom, and his goods, and departed. And there came one that had escaped and told Abram the Hebrew. Keep in mind something that's going to help you through this entire study today. Notice how Abram is called the Hebrew there. Well, Moses is writing Genesis 14. And when Moses writes this, he's writing it about 1450 B.C., and the events that you're reading about are taking place around 1950 B.C., about 500 years before that. So when he talks about Abram the Hebrew, God hadn't designated a Hebrew nation by this time. However, later he knew that was, and Abram is the beginning of the Hebrew people. And that's very significant, and this is one of the reasons why the Muslim people have a Quran. They couldn't possibly stand to read this book and find out that Abram was the Hebrew, and therefore the people of choice for God were the Jews and not the Muslims of Islam through Ishmael. You got that? Okay. For he dwelt in the plain of Mamre, the Amorite, brother of Eshcol and brother of Aner, and these were confederate with him. You see, the Bible is way more up to date than most people think. These guys are the Southern Army. They are. They're down here, and these other guys are coming from up here. They're the Southern Army. And when the Southern armies get together and form a group, they are confederate. And in the South, we had the Confederate fighting against the Union above. You're not going to get away from a Bible no matter how hard you try. It can't happen. And when Abram heard that his brother was taken captive, he armed his trained servants, born in his own house, 318, and pursued them unto Dan. That's significant. We'll come back to it. And he divided himself against them, he and his servants, by night, and smote them and pursued them unto Hobab, which is on the left hand of Damascus. They're on the way home. They're high-tailing it, and he's whooping them all the way back. And he brought back all the goods, and also brought again his brother Lot, his goods, and the women also, and the people. And then he goes on and meets Melchizedek and some other things like that. Now, that's a fairly straightforward. There's not a whole lot here that's difficult, okay? You're understanding what you read here. The four kings were upset because the five kings rebel. They go down there and they steal from them. And the reason they do that is that generally when one set of countries has control over another set of countries, there's an economic advantage. They're getting something for it. And when all of a sudden that's going to dry up, they figure, well, we might as well get all we can while we can because this deal is over. It's no more a friendship deal. And so we have some things that are here that show up in this. Now, I've got an outline here that shows you several things, but I'm not going to follow it precisely. We're going to just deal with things as they come up and then try to cover everything that's in here. For one thing you want to notice in verse 5 is there are MMs. There are MMs. MMs were giants. Turn to Deuteronomy chapter 2. And that's important to remember because back in Genesis chapter 6, we found out there were giants in the land in those days. Remember that? And those giants came from women who had some problem with the sons of God, fallen angels, as it turns out. Their offspring were giants. Well, the flood didn't kill them all out. Everybody that was alive, except for Noah and his wife and their three sons and their wives, died. But evidently, these guys got showing up again because there are a bunch more giants back there. And the MMs are some of these giants. Look in Deuteronomy chapter 2 at verse 10 and 11. The MMs dwelt therein in time past. And the area that he's talking about, you'll see, is going to be the area we're talking about today. The MMs dwelt there in times past, a people great and many, and tall as the Anakims, tall, which also were accounted giants as the Anakims. But the Moabites called them MMs. The Horims also dwelt in Seir, that's where we're talking about right now, before time, but the children of Esau succeeded them when they had destroyed them from before them and dwelt in their stead as Israel did unto the land of his possession, which the Lord gave unto them. Look at verse 19. When thou comest nigh over against the children of Ammon, distress them not, nor meddle with them, for I will not give thee of the land of the children of Ammon any possession, because I have given it unto the children of Lot for a possession. That also was accounted a land of giants. Giants dwelt therein in old time, and the Ammonites called them Zamzumims, a people great and many and tall as the Anakims. But the Lord destroyed them before them, and they succeeded them and dwelt in their stead. Now what you have then is this. In the days that Lot and Abram are up here, in this area, overlooking this place that Lot goes, this area down here is inhabited. And there are some giants down in that area. Later on, as Esau is born, and he goes in to take this area, he ends up down here below the Dead Sea, That's his possession. Moab ends up next to him, and Ammon ends up over here to the east of the Dead Sea. And that whole region had some giants scattered in that area, and they went in there and beat those guys and then eventually took their possessions. Okay? So the MMs is a clue that those guys are there even at the time that Lot goes in. All right, notice another thing. Notice that in verse 14, when the battle is on and Abram is going after these bad guys, they pursue them in verse 14 up to what? Up to what? Dan. Who is Dan? He's one of the tribes of Israel. He's one of the 12 sons. All right, here's an interesting thing. When Moses wrote this, had the Jews gone into the land of Canaan yet? You got to think for a second. No, they didn't. Moses got to take them up to the promised land, but Moses died. This would be better if this was stiff. David was going to try to pin it to the wall. That might even be better. But Moses took them all the way up here to the River Jordan, and they stopped just outside of the River Jordan, and Moses died out here. Then Joshua was the one that took them in there. All right? The first group to get a possession was whom? Do you remember? Anybody remember? The first group to get a possession was Judah. And Simeon went in him to get his possession. And when you read all through the book of Joshua, all the tribes have not gotten their possession by the time that Joshua's book comes to a close. You don't see Dan getting their possession until Judges chapter 17 and 18. Way after Joshua, way after Moses. Dan's original possession started out here on the seacoast, and they thought it was too small for them. Actually, there were some other people there they didn't want to fight. So they send some people out, and they get up in here in the way north part, up above the Sea of Galilee, and they find a city up there called Laish, and it's not protected. And they don't have a lot of trade with anybody else, and so these guys are easy picking. So they go up into that area and destroy that city and call that city Dan, and they take that possession after Moses and after Joshua are dead. Now, how did that thing Dan get in there? Isn't that wild? You know what that tells you? That tells you beyond the shadow. Well, I'll tell you what it tells the scholars. It tells the scholars Moses didn't write this. Somebody else wrote it years later and attributed all this to Moses. That's not true. Jesus Christ said Moses wrote it. You know who told Moses about Dan? Was the Holy Spirit. And so when he locates the area of Laish on the way to Damascus, these men are running to get back to their area, he calls that thing Dan, not even knowing that Dan will inherit that, but knowing that God told him to write that down there. Now, that is just one of those people said, did God tell them what to write? Absolutely. They had to know what to put in here for you and I. How he told them, the method, all that kind of stuff, you know, people have argued about that. That place is Dan, called Dan in Genesis 14, long before the man that wrote this even knew that Dan would inhabit the area. That's a miracle. It's a miracle. I gave you the references there in Judges 17 and 18 for you to read about that. Now, here's another thing. These four kings are from an area in the plain of Shinar. Notice up here in verse 1 again, Amraphel, king of Shinar, whatever that is. Does that name Shinar ring a bell with you at all? That's where the Tower of Babel was set up. And so we studied Nimrod when we were back there in Genesis chapter 10 and 11 and found out what he was doing is what the Antichrist is going to be doing before Jesus Christ comes back. And so when you see these four kings going after the five kings and others that are down below there making an attack for an economic advantage and to continue their control over the area, I mean, if you steal all the people, get all the money, these people are going to be defenseless. You can keep them under your power and under your control. That's what the United Nations is going to do. That's what the United Nations has already done. When the United Nations sets up a peacekeeping force in a foreign country, it's because they want to control them to do in that country what the United Nations wants them to do. And that's what these kings were doing. This is a picture then of what the United Nations is doing now, and it's a picture of what Mystery Babylon, Shinar, Nebuchadnezzar, Daniel, Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego, image, bow down, worship, Nimrod. It's all connected from the very beginning of the Bible to the very end of the Bible. That stuff is all connected. Did I run that connection too fast for you? I ran it fast. But do you understand? In Genesis 10, we find Nimrod, a type of the Antichrist, in the plain of Shinar. His kingdom is called Babel, which gives rise to Babylon. We're now in Genesis chapter 14. The kings surrounding Shinar are in control of the kings in the known living world at the time. They go in militarily to take control, like the Antichrist's kings and forces will do during the tribulation. And the funny thing about it is Abram the Hebrew beats them with a small army. And that's what's going to happen to the United Nations. In the tribulation, when they try to control the world, Jesus Christ is going to come back. And who is Jesus Christ? He's a Jew. He said salvation is of the Jews, and he's going to win. And the intention is to do something to get those nations to attack down in that area. They're just going to attack a little north of where they did this time. They're going to attack up near Jerusalem. Look in Zephaniah 3:8 real quick, and you'll see that. Now, I said that with a great deal of speed, assuming that you would know all of that, but the reason is I've just left the book of Isaiah, and it comes up as a repeating theme throughout the entire book of Isaiah, and after a while, it kind of just runs itself in your brain. Zephaniah 3:8. I'll give you a chance to find that one. You got Malachi, Zechariah, Haggai, Zephaniah, going backwards from the end of the Old Testament. And it's a short one, three little pages, so it's not easy to find. Find Matthew, you know where that is. Then go backwards, Malachi, backwards, Zechariah, backwards, Haggai, backwards, Zephaniah. That's the easy way to find it. Chapter 3 and verse 8. All right, now Zephaniah 3:8. Therefore wait ye upon me, saith the Lord, until the day that I rise up to the what? Prey. What did Abram recover? He recovered the prey, the people and the spoil. Till I rise up to the prey, for my determination is to gather the nations that I may assemble, that used to be called the United Nations Assembly, that I may assemble the kingdoms to pour upon them mine indignation, even all my fierce anger, for all the earth shall be devoured with the fire of my jealousy. What happens in Sodom, Gomorrah, Adma, and Zeboam after this war is over? It's destroyed with the fire of his jealousy. Abram recovers this thing. They all go right back down to the area. Lot doesn't wise up but sticks around town. Should have figured it was time to leave. He didn't. And eventually the angels come in there and destroy that city with fire. Fire and brimstone. That's very important because it leads to something else. All right, so we see these kind of things going on here. Now, note, watch the wording of this. Watch how the wording of this is in verse 3. Okay, verse 2, first of all, are the kings of Sodom, Gomorrah, Adma, Zeboam, and Zoar, which is called Bela. Okay, back in Genesis chapter 14, verse 2. Five kings down there. Where are these? All these were joined together in the what? In the vale of Siddim, comma, which is the salt sea. That's strange wording. That may not seem so strange to you, but let me show you why it's strange wording. He says, all these were gathered in the vale of Siddim. What did Lot... That's a big sea. You ever notice that? What is it that Lot saw over here when he decided to head southeast into that area? What did he see? He's all green grass. It was called the Plain of Jordan. And when he describes it in chapter 13, even as the garden of the Lord, like the land of Egypt, as thou comest unto Zoar. Look at Genesis chapter 13, verse 10. Lot lifted up his eyes and beheld all the plain of Jordan, that it was well watered everywhere before the Lord destroyed Sodom and Gomorrah. Even as the garden of the Lord, like the land of Egypt, as thou comest unto Zoar. Now a valley is called a valley because it's low. And in that valley, then, you would either have a stream or you'd have a lake in there at the bottom of that thing, and then the cities would get around there, and then the herds would pasture out. It's what you see when you go through any valley in the United States of America, except for Death Valley. Same kind of deal. There's always some sort of a stream, a river, or a lake down there, and good pasture and all that kind of stuff. That's where people want to be, mild temperatures and everything. But he says that vale is called the Salt Sea. Now remember again, Moses is writing this after Sodom and Gomorrah are destroyed. Remember? We kind of read it, and we think we're reading it, that he wrote it as a journal. I made an entry in my journal. Before this happened, Moses wasn't even around. See, all these things had to be related to him by the Lord and others. In other words, what you're reading is the lower part of the Dead Sea, evidently, was that veil. And that water in that sea was good. I mean, what happens? Fresh water from the Sea of Galilee and the Jordan River flow into it, and it's dead. And then there's a valley that runs on out of there to Ezgeber. That's a strange thing. And that all that fresh water keeps flowing in there, and it doesn't get that place any fresher. It's just a salt sea, and it's rich, rich, rich in minerals, but it's the deadest place on the earth, and so we call it the Dead Sea. In other words, what it looks like is that when God rained in there fire and brimstone, he rained in there something else, salt, and turned what? Lot's wife into a pillar of salt and rained that salt into that thing. So when he calls the Vale of Siddim the Salt Sea, it's what it is now when he's writing it, not what it was when Lot went down there. You got that? Because the cities that were there are gone. They're destroyed. If you could dive to the bottom, and if there were anything that survived the cinders, you might find remains of the cities on the bottom of the sea. And it sunk. Isn't it the low place in the earth? That's a very interesting thing. Look in Deuteronomy chapter 29 again. We've been over there earlier. Look at Deuteronomy chapter 29 at verse 23. Deuteronomy chapter 29, verse 23. Now look how this goes. And that the whole land thereof is brimstone and what? Salt and burning, that is not sown, nor beareth, nor any grass groweth, used to, therein, like the overthrow of Sodom, Gomorrah, Admah, and Zeboam, which the Lord overthrew in his anger and in his wrath. Now, he didn't overthrow Zoar. Why? We'll study it, actually, when we get to Genesis 19. Why? Because when Lot first ran out of Sodom and Gomorrah, where did he run? He didn't run to the mountains like the angel told him to. He ran to the little city, Bela, which is Zoar. That's not destroyed. The other four cities are, and the destruction was not only with burning and brimstone, it was also with salt. So now it's the Salt Sea. That's interesting. You see, God is very, very frugal with his wording and gets a whole lot done in a very short little space because he's so precise with his wording. Now, that leads us to some things that are really interesting about this little Dead Sea thing, this little valley that we're looking at here that turns into the Salt Sea. Because during the millennial reign of Christ, that area that we're reading about is going to be hell on earth. I mean, right now, where is hell? I mean, where do you think it is? Yeah, in the lower parts of the earth, where Jesus descended after his death. It's in the lower parts of the earth, and you guys that have any knowledge of the oil business know that when they start drilling down in there and get pretty deep, you know, 3 whatever miles, things start getting hot and things start getting a lot of pressure. And what comes up from the heart of the earth through the mouth of a volcano is lava, molten lava. So this Dead Sea that we're talking about, and we'll look at a verse here in just a minute, is going to be the location of a literal hell on the earth. A literal hell on the earth. Now I'll show you that real quick. Turn to Isaiah 34. And there's a reason for this. Going to be a literal hell on earth. Isaiah chapter 34. I've heard that. I've also heard that from deep soundings in these really tight vessels that men can descend way deep into the earth, ocean. I've heard that same thing from that, get into those crevices. Now, please keep in mind something. We don't say what we say in the English language when we're using slang because we thought of it. We say it because it is an indication of what God thought of and what's really going to happen. Have you ever heard anybody say, this is so bad, this is hell on earth? That's prophetic. And have you ever heard anybody tell somebody else, go jump in a lake, and there's no lake even visible? They're not saying go jump in a lake like water. They're talking about fire. And the other one, when you really get mad, is you don't tell them to go jump in the lake, you tell them to go to H-E-L-L. And why do people say that? Because it's Bible. It's Bible. The Bible actually controls our language, and sometimes we just don't give God the credit. Look at verse 5 in Isaiah 34. For my sword shall be bathed in heaven. Behold, it shall come down upon Idumea. Guess where Idumea is? Idumea is the region below the Salt Sea that we've been looking at. Upon the people of my curse to judgment, the sword of the Lord is filled with blood. It is made fat with fatness, and with the blood of lambs and goats and the fat of the kidneys of rams. For the Lord hath a sacrifice in Bozrah. Guess where Bozrah is? Right below the Dead Sea, right in this area we're talking about. And a great slaughter in the land of Idumea. And the unicorns shall come down with them. Unicorns are real. They're just not here yet. They're in heaven. And the bullocks with the bulls and their land shall be soaked with blood, and their dust made fat with fatness. For it is the day of the Lord's vengeance, the year of recompenses for the controversy of Zion. Second advent, second coming of Christ. Watch it. And the streams thereof shall be turned into pitch. What did they have in the area we were just looking at? Slime pits. You know what slime pits are? They are remains of oil deposits. And the land thereof shall become burning pitch. That's what happened. It shall not be quenched night nor day. An unquenchable burning pitch is hell. The smoke thereof shall go up forever and ever from generation to generation. It shall lie waste. None shall pass through it forever and ever. All right, turn to Revelation chapter 14. So this burning pitch that never goes out is on the earth. It's on the earth during after the second coming of Christ. Revelation chapter 14, look at verse 9. Revelation chapter 14, look at verse 9. And the third angel followed them, saying with a loud voice, if any man worship the beast in his image and receive his mark in his forehead or in his hand, the same shall drink of the wine of the wrath of God, which is poured out without mixture into the cup of his indignation. And he shall be tormented with what? Fire and brimstone. That's what got Sodom and Gomorrah. In the presence of the holy angels, not down below in the unholy angels where they're reserved in darkness, in the presence of the holy angels, and in the presence of the Lamb, and the smoke of their torment ascendeth up forever and ever, and they have no rest, day nor night, who worship the beast in his image, and whosoever receiveth the mark of his name. Well, it looks like then if it's in the presence of his holy angels, it's where people can see it. One more verse, Isaiah 66. Isaiah chapter 66, verse 24. And they shall go forth. Watch verse 23. It shall come to pass that from one new moon to another and from one Sabbath to another shall all flesh, these are people alive during the 1,000-year reign of Christ, all flesh come to worship before me, saith the Lord, and they shall go forth and look upon the carcasses of the men that have transgressed against me. They're going to be able to see them. For their worms shall not die, neither shall their fire be quenched, and they shall be an abhorring unto all flesh. They can see them. The second coming of the Lord Jesus Christ follows the tribulation right here. That goes on toward eternity. And the Lord has a 1,000-year reign on the earth. And during that 1,000-year reign, there are people literally burning in that pitch. And whenever they get out of line with Christ, they get thrown in there, which is a real incentive for people to do right. we'd be more likely to do everything God told us to do if we realized, And then at the end of that 1,000 years, there is a burning of the entire earth. Hell delivers up the dead that are in it. They're judged at the white throne judgment, cast into the lake of fire, and hell that's on this earth is totally wiped out at the end.
but not over here. For that 1,000 years, it's on the earth. Okay?
Father, we're so thankful that how often we've looked at the Bible and said, oh, it's so dull. And actually, the truth is, we're dull, and this book is tremendous. And we're so privileged to have it. We're so thankful that you gave it to us. We're so thankful that you've given us preachers and teachers that have gone before that knew that it was your word and that preached to us that it was your word and that your Holy Spirit has convinced us of your word, and then you've illuminated us so we can see great things in your word. And we ask you please now to bless what we know, that we never get to a place where knowledge puffeth up, but where we always reside, and that is with charity. Charity edifieth. And we ask you to edify us with your word, for Jesus' sake. Amen.